You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters, and this week in partnership with Loughborough University. Now, in these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer specializing in food and science. Now, the title of this podcast is Cooking with Electricity. Now, I know that might sound like a 1960s government information project, but hang on right there, because this is actually pretty futuristic, fascinating, world-changing stuff. We're going to be tackling deforestation, the downsides of cooking with biomass, cooking in the developing world, cutting deaths from household air pollution, and calling out for partners to join in an extraordinary project. Now, I'm joined by a panel of guests from Loughborough University. We have Ed Brown, Modern Energy Cooking Services Research Director.
Hello.
Nick Russo, International Liaison Manager.
Hello.
Simon Batchelor, UK Research and Innovation Coordinator.
Hi.
And Ann Tran, International Liaison Manager.
G'day.
Now, we're going to discuss the programme, which it's the MECS, Modern Energy Cooking Services. And the idea is it could help save 4 million lives a year across the developing world by changing how people cook. Simon Batchelor, now, I understand you were the originator of the programme. What is it and what is the problem that you're setting out to solve?
So it's pretty remarkable in this day and age when we're considering going to Mars and we're going back to the moon and everything, that actually 3 billion people on the planet still cook with wood and charcoal for their main cooking needs. And as you said in your introduction, that actually causes respiratory problems, non-communicable diseases, problems with the heart, such that 4 million lives a year are cut short. I mean, put that in the context of COVID. We're recording this in late June. We've just passed the mark where 500,000 people have died. Actually, every year for the last X years, I don't know how many, 4 million people have had their lives cut short from this basically an extreme public health problem. And that's breathing in the smoke and emissions from the charcoal and wood that they're using.
So I've filmed in refugee camps in Uganda, for instance. I think people don't really understand, but people have a hut and they will cook inside it. And if you're inside that hut whilst cooking, it's a very cultural thing as well. But when you're cooking inside it, it is horrible. You know, I couldn't stay in there. These amazing women who cook in the huts are a lot more used to it. But it's a sort of hidden problem in a way, isn't it? That millions of people die every year from something as basic as cooking inside.
Yes. And I mean, your image of a hut is correct. In fact, there are a few windows and the hut is probably got a corrugated sheet roof. So It's getting hot. It's just a ridiculously bad situation given where we are in the 21st century. And yet that is almost half the world is experiencing that.
And we just don't really realize that, do we?
No, we don't. So there has been action. Over the last 40 years, people have tried to solve that problem by improving the combustion of the charcoal and the wood. And so we get what are called improved cook stoves. But actually, recent research over the last 10 years has shown that those cook stoves barely improve the situation. They do use very slightly less wood, they're less charcoal. But again, going back to your image, Stefan, the woman is still there in that room, in all that smoke, still cooking in a ridiculous situation. So there were beginnings of calls for something alternative. What was the alternative approach? All the predictions were that actually these rollout of these improved cook stoves wasn't even keeping up with population growth. And so we would reach 2030 and still have over 3 billion people cooking in this way. The thing that Modern Energy Cooking Services brought to the table was that there was this weird phenomena in the development world that cooking was spoken of in this room and electrification was spoken of in a completely different room. So actually the progress on electrification over the last 10 years, 20 years has been quite significant. So if we look at Asia, we've got 65% in 2000 were connected to electricity. Now, It's 94%. It's nearly there. And yet 1.7 billion people live in Asia still cooking with biomass. Mm-hmm. So we asked ourselves the question, is it possible now to cook with electricity? Is it cost effective? Is it affordable? How do the renewable energies influence that?
And so basically, this is a whole new approach looking at this because of the advances of electrification, and that shifts the focus really on improved cook stoves was one of the solutions. But now you're thinking of a whole new approach. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, your example was the extreme situation, refugee camp in the back end of Uganda somewhere. Actually, there are a lot of people. Urbanization is a thing, and cities in Africa are predicted to double in the next 10 years. So there's a lot of people living in apartments, in small houses that have connections to electricity, but don't cook with electricity. So we here in UK, we're used to cooking with electricity. And you know, some of the Scandinavian countries only cook with electricity. We have our natural gas, so we balance between it. And I suspect many of the listeners to this podcast are professional chefs, and they're all going to go, oh, yeah, but you don't get the controlling aspect of gas with electricity. Well, you can't control charcoal and wood. You light the fire, and then off it goes. We've all done our barbecues. We all know how difficult it is to control. And so that step into the world of controllable electric cooking is an amazing step for people. And we've now found these energy efficient appliances. We've found electric pressure cookers, the Instant Pot. Well, I probably shouldn't say too many brand names, but Instant Pot are one of the leaders. And those can cook long, heavy foods, which is what a lot of Africans eat, in about one fifth of the energy that an electric hot plate would take. And the cost is about one fifth of what people in urban situations are paying for their charcoal and wood.
Now, this is extraordinary because if we go back to this idea of electricity, do you think it's a sort of it's a slightly patronizing approach for us to think that a lot of countries around the world don't have access to electricity? Do we need to change our mindset about the availability of different power sources?
It's changing quickly. So, you know, there are still 800 million people that do not have access to electricity. And often access to electricity is in a lower tier. They get lower quality and they can't immediately switch to cooking. But if we're looking to the future 10 years, you know, the renewable energy is becoming much, much cheaper. This whole thing started because we saw the price of PV panels coming down. And most importantly, we saw the price of energy storage coming down. All this Tesla stuff with batteries, all the electric cars, that is reducing the price of batteries. And batteries actually overcome many of the shortfalls of weak grid electricity and weak electricity.
If we go a little bit further with this, I gather the UK government's provided funding for Modern Energy Cooking Services Programme. And can you take up the story now and explain a little bit more about it and how it unfolds?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. So the Department for International Development, as is at the moment, obviously undergoing a merger at the moment with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, but yeah, our understanding is that we're now 2 years into a five-year programme, we're doing this very large programme supported by the UK government alongside the World Bank. So it's a global program, really, obviously focusing on those parts of the world where the issues that Simon's just described are most intense. So that's in South Asia and in large parts of sub-Saharan Africa. And I suppose the best way of describing what we're doing is we have five different kind of strands of work that we're doing that add up to this attempt to completely rethink the way in which we're approaching this. So we've talked a lot about electric cooking. We are also interested in other ways in which we can address the limitations of the current ways of doing things. So modern energy cooking services is trying to rethink this way that's been dominant about thinking about how we address this issue for about the last 20 or 30 years. So the five areas we're focusing on are, one is simply, what do we currently know? Why do we think we can't cook with electricity? Why do we think that LPG is not an appropriate fuel in certain markets and so on? So we're working really closely with a whole range of different partners to evaluate exactly where we are in terms of our understanding of markets and prices and all of the kind of factors affecting the transition. So we have a big study coming out within the next week or so, which is the first real detailed study of the market for electric cooking, for example. So then we have a second area, which is about technology and technology and innovation. So into that area, it's working with universities and other partners and innovators around, for example, we know that there are electric pressure cookers available. And that they are currently utilized a lot in Europe and the US, not so much in other parts of the world. Number one is, are they suitable for using not only on an AC national grid, but also off-grid? And the answer to that question at the moment is there aren't very many of them, and the ones that are out there are maybe not amongst the best. So one of the things we're looking to innovate on is, how can we develop a more effective DC version of the electric pressure cooker that then solar home systems, mini grid companies and so on can utilize? And then very quickly, the other three areas are data and how we measure the success that we're or otherwise that we're having, and how we can connect what we're doing in this area into the broader intentions of the international community in terms of meeting the Sustainable Development Goals. Secondly is, how do we find the finance to achieve the scale up that we're talking about in these kinds of areas? And then thirdly, how do we accelerate international commitment to these issues? So during a time at the moment in relation to COVID, we've noticed that there's a lot of talk about electrifying health centers and so on and so forth, as you might imagine. But actually, there's a very strong connection into the whole kind of a question about comorbidity from different diseases, and COVID seems to affect people worse if they have pre-existing lung conditions. Also, is COVID going to affect people in the future because they've become weakened due to this? But also simply the what are the impacts of a 4 or 5 year recession going to be? We know what that's going to be like here. We have an assumption of what it's going to be like here. You can imagine a country where there's no social security or very little social security, then what are the implications there? So it's a very broad program. It ranges from knowledge and understanding kind of where we are, right the way through new forms of technology, new business models, new ways of understanding how people cook, right the way through to issues to do with finance, to do with government commitment and policy making and all those kinds of things.
What's interesting is it's not just a dream that you have of doing something fantastic, but there are compartmentalized achievements along the way. Can you expand a little bit on that? I mean, how do you roll this out?
That's a brilliant question. So there is some work that has to go on at the global level with the major institutions saying, look, you need to think about this issue. You need to look at how we are channeling resources into how we deal with this and what things you are supporting. At the same level, we also need to be working with individual companies. So that could be a mini grid operator in Kenya who is selling electricity to the consumers on their grid, and maybe they're using it for a little bit of television, radio, lighting, and so on. And they're actually not being able to sell as much electricity through that grid as they were originally.
And are there lots of these little mini grids? It's the first time I've come across the term.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So in countries across Africa, the level of access to electricity may be as low as 20 or 30%, even lower than that in some cases. And in order to bring electricity into those communities, especially where they are miles away from large urban centres, then mini-grids are often presented as the most cost-effective way of doing that, rather than extending a national grid. I mean, there's a whole other set of debates about, are we actually better off going down that route in terms of distributed generation here in the West? But in terms of this is happening now. So one of the programs we're working on is in Nigeria, where the World Bank is investing in a significant program of expansion of mini-grids. So one of the things we're looking at there is not only about those mini-grids providing access to mobile phone charging, lighting, that kind of thing, but also actually where people are paying for their fuels. And that's important because we're not talking about a giveaway. We're talking about building markets that actually create a long-term sustainable future. So in those places where there is a market, because people are already buying fuel, they're not just going and chopping trees down, if you see what I mean, then in those circumstances, if we can show that there is a price equivalence, then actually not only is that beneficial for people's living conditions and cooking conditions, but it's also beneficial for the companies trying to develop those business models of the mini grids and so on.
And I think it's quite important to explain this to people really well, isn't it? Because there is a perception that if you want to do good, go and give something to people. That'll sort problems out. But of course, the moment you drop a bag of food or some infrastructure for free, you kind of ruin local markets. You know, the value of things locally suddenly either disappears or it imbalances things. And there's a real danger in that old-fashioned approach of emergency relief, of just giving stuff, whereas really what you want to do is integrate that into the local economy.
Absolutely. And all of us, I think, on this call have been working in international development for many years, and we've seen that. So like one of the things that we've observed over the years with the Clean Cookstoves program, not so much recently because I think they've learned the lessons of this, but for a long time, you would go and visit a Clean Cookstoves project. You'd see the people saying, it was sort of, you go into their house, say, look, this is our wonderful new cookstove. Isn't it fantastic? They gave it to us over there. Aren't they nice people? You go back 6 months later, where's your cookstove? Oh, it's in the garden over there. We're using it as a flower arrangement, you know, or whatever it might be, because it wasn't valued in that sense. And it didn't necessarily bring them an economic benefit. It was only something that was there because it had been designed and produced by someone from outside. So what we're really trying to do is make sure that what we're producing is something that people will use, that's something that people will want to purchase and will value for a whole host of different reasons. And I think the really exciting thing about cooking with electricity is not only does it have health implications and improvements, not only does it address carbon and stopping people from cutting down forests and so on, but also it's clean. So, and I don't mean that in a health sense. I mean in the sense of, you know, for example, with an electric a pressure cooker, you're going to make a bean dish that can save you time. So you can cook in this bean dish in about half the time it would take you to cook it on charcoal. But also, once you know how to utilize it, you put the beans, the ingredients in, you maybe do a little bit of frying to begin with to give it a little bit of extra flavor, and then you put the top on and you press the button and you walk away and you can A, not be smelling of smoke if you need to go out to a meeting afterwards, you don't need to go and get changed, but also you know you can leave it, it's not going to stick onto the bottom, because that's one of the massive advantages of a pressurized and in particular non-stick container. You can go off and do something else. You can be sure that the kids are not going to be in danger because there's an open fire or whatever reason. So it's a whole host of different issues together that bring these different benefits. And actually, it's something that's quite aspirational in the way that an improved cookstove is slightly better. It's got, you know, you can use slightly less fuel, you save a bit of money, which is great, fantastic. But with this pressure cooker, then not only are you saving money, but also it's clean. It allows you to go and do other things, you know, and so on. So it's that's the complexity of this issue. Cooking is an issue that has got so many cultural, health, environmental implications to it, but we treat it as something that's very, very simple. Mm.
And I mean, the problems fall sort of disproportionately on the shoulders of women, I think, as well. But we'll come on to that in a little while. Now, how are you supporting innovation within the programme?
A whole variety of different ways. We have now run, I think it's four different types of challenge fund activity. So with two of them, we've run ourselves, and we've called these MEX challenge fund activities. We had, I think, in a first round that we called MEX TRID, we had around, I think it was 18 companies or grassroots organizations that we supported small scale projects on. And this was where there was an idea. So it might be an idea that a very innovative idea, for example, phase change materials. So in other words, could you actually heat these materials directly from the sun and then use that heat later on? So at the moment, you know, sort of solar cooking is another kind of part of all this, but had a really bad rap over the years because you have to use it outside in the sun, has particular implications. Other types of materials that absorb heat and then you can utilize that heat for cooking at other times. It's relatively new technology, but we supported an industry to look at that. We had another one where we looked at the different types of batteries that you might use for cooking and whether there was something we could do in terms of second life of lithium ion batteries that could reduce the cost for this kind of purpose. New types of approaches to the distribution of LPG, new types of approaches towards pay-as-you-go LPG, market testing of new electric pressure cookers in different circumstances. So lots of different attempts to slightly change a business model, to develop the next type of technology and so on. So that's the kind of what we were doing there. We just have a new round of those that we're just contracting. I think there are 13 of them in 9 different countries, and these are all to do specifically with electric pressure cookers and particularly to do with market testing. And they're slightly larger, longer projects. I think they're about 60,000 each to each company, and they're trialing, for example, on mini grids. They're trialing, say, 100 pressure cookers with customers, taking the stories of the people that are using them in their homes, cooking different meals. What are they cooking? How are they cooking? How are they finding it? And then using that information to further improve the business model of both the manufacturer of that device and also the mini grid operator in terms of their bottom line from that. So those are quite small targeted projects. On the other hand, we also are working with a number of on another program which has got slightly bigger programs. So there it's kind of like a more wholesale development with a particular developer about how do we develop your strategy. For example, we have one company in Kenya that's producing their own pressure cooker specifically targeted for the Kenyan market. So it's being designed in a way that so it's entirely produced and manufactured in Kenya. Also, rather than if you buy one from China, then most of the symbols on it relate to how you cook meals in China or particularly in the West. Whereas this one, all of them, the knobs and buttons and so on, they all relate to particular dishes in East Africa. Yeah. So it's that kind of thing.
Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Now, yeah. Let's move on to Simon. You're the UK Research and Innovation Coordinator. This programme clearly involves a lot of research. Can you give us a flavour of some of the research that you've done?
Yes. So Ed keeps emphasising these pressure cookers, but the thing is, this is about cooking real meals for real people, and you don't mess with people's food. It's got to taste right. It's got to be culturally acceptable. So one of the other mistakes that the clean cooking, improved cook stove sector made was they focused on how quickly can you boil water, because they were trying to get the combustion efficiency of the charcoal and the wood improved. they focused on the boiling of the water side of things and didn't take into account how people eat, when they eat, you know, what are they actually doing? So a lot of our research is in things like cooking diaries. We find families that are currently cooking with charcoal and wood. We monitor them with their permission, obviously, them for 2-3 weeks, find out what their menu is, and what sequence they're cooking their meals. As Ed was saying, you fry your onions, then you add your meat, etc. Then we swap them out with, say, an electric pressure cooker. But again, I don't want to emphasize that too much. There are other energy efficient appliances emerging there.
But I think it's really interesting for people to understand that the context of this is really important, because the cultural aspect of how you, it seems obvious, here's a better way of doing it, you won't be ill from smoke fumes, just do it. Well, there's a vast cultural impact.
If it doesn't taste right, you've got problems. So a lot of people will say, oh, but I like the smoky flavor, or at least, actually, interestingly, a lot of Westerners like us will say, oh, but the Africans like their smoky flavor. Actually, so some of our research has been to do, I won't bore you with the techie process, but it's called discrete choice modeling, where you can get honest answers from people. And when we get that honest answers across bigger populations, actually, smoky flavor is not the key issue. And actually, people will say that it tastes okay, even when it's cooked within these modern appliances.
And so things like the diary studies and things like that are really interesting. What did you discover from that? What else, other than things like taste and flavor? What about cost and you know, the actual sort of needs for energy storage and things like that?
Yeah. So cost was a huge one. We found that if you cooked the same meal, so again, I'm not talking about boiling water, talking about cooking a meal, then the same meal within Nairobi, actually charcoal, kerosene, LPG gas, and electricity on a hot plate, so not an efficient device, they all come out much of a muchness, 30 to 35 Kenya shillings for that meal. But the electric pressure cooker as an energy efficient device, that came out down at sort of the 7 or 8 shillings. So it's about 1/5 of the cost that people are currently paying. And that's an important point that Ed made along the way, which is there is a current expenditure on fuels, particularly for the urban situation. And that expenditure can be converted into this cleaner fuel. That is a gain for the utility. That is a gain for tax revenue for governments, because suddenly, instead of an informal charcoal sector that you can't tax, you're suddenly you know, have it in one place. There are so many gains, and I just wanted to pick up on one gain that Ed skipped over, which is the climate change. So black carbon are little particulates that are created when you burn wood and charcoal incompletely. And some scientists say that black carbon is the second most forceful thing in the whole of climate change. It's a short-lived climate forcing agent, so it disappears relatively quickly. But we have 3 billion people producing new black carbon every day. And so actually action on this could create a very quick response to climate change.
And what about the different aspects of this? So different solutions for different tools. I mean, in Uganda, we had a lot of ugali. It's a pretty simple dish. It's a really big, pasty, carb dish. But what about things like bread making and things like that, which is an enormously important food around the world? I mean, how do you cope with that with electricity? I mean, that's a long process that involves a huge amount of fuel. Can this sort of shift to electricity cope with that?
So there are still some challenges, bread making, chapatis, that sort of stuff. I mean, the electric pressure cooker companies are just beginning to introduce air fryers, top loading that you put on your. So you could still conceive of a single device with two different lids, and that lid different cooking effects. But the important thing is, if I can just jump back to the cooking diaries, what we saw was that people didn't have to change their menu. So what they were cooking could be cooked within these different devices. And you talked about, well, bread making can take a long time. Believe me, Matoke in Uganda takes a huge amount of time. So you're supposed to steam it for an hour. You wrap it in banana leaves. You steam it for an hour. You then take it out. You wrap it with new banana leaves. And then you boil, stroke, steam for another 3 to 4 hours. So I had the experience that I was in front of a whole group of policymakers and government and people in Uganda. I'd never cooked Matoke before, but they had given me 3 students who knew how to cook Matoke, but 3 pressure cookers. And they said, well, can you cook Matoke in the pressure cooker? I said, I don't know. Right, let's give it a go. So the students wrapped it up and put it in the pressure cooker. And I said, right, so what would you normally do? They said, we would steam it for an hour. Okay, I don't know, let's give it 20 minutes. So we gave it 20 minutes, unwrapped it. Oh, man, that's right. Okay, let's wrap it up again, put it back in. Now what would you do? Oh, well, now we would boil or steam it for 3 hours. All right, well, let's give it 50 minutes. You know, and when it came out, there were 70 people in the room. They were all polite. I don't know. They have reassured me several times after the event that they weren't just being polite, but they were all going, oh, my goodness, this tastes proper. This is the right sort of food. So, yeah, it can address local foods and local tastes.
And that's really important. Now, I understand that you're also looking at the scope for food to be pre-cooked before it gets to household. I mean, that's, again, it's another fundamental change. How does this work?
So what we saw in the cooking diaries was that 25% of their meals are reheated. So they're not afraid of leftovers and then reheating them the next day. And most of their food is being cooked from the raw. So if we look at Britain, the amount of energy we actually expend in the kitchen has reduced by half since 1970. And that's due mainly to 3 things. One is increasingly efficient devices, so that your fan-driven oven is more efficient than an oven without a fan. But it's also an uptake of pre-cooked food. It's the TV dinners. It's the putting it in the microwave, reheating type stuff. The 3rd reason is somebody changed the statistics and took kettles and microwaves out of the kitchen, which is crazy. That's the trend in developed economies, that actually the energy is applied to the food somewhere other than in your kitchen. And there's an opportunity for reducing what the burden on the family of, particularly when we're talking solar cells, driving a battery and cooking meals, if we could actually shift half of that energy into a factory such that you bought. So this is a tin of pre-cooked beans. So beans take forever to cook from raw, but Canadian researchers have set up a factory and identified the 12 varieties that can be pre-cooked and retain all their nutrition. They have stimulated farmers around the factory to actually produce the beans, and then they've started pre-cooking them and selling them in Nairobi. Can imagine many of your viewers are saying, yeah, but look, it's in a plastic tub. We don't want plastic packaging, but we'll tackle that one a little bit later.
But also, this is a whole new potential for industry. Now, in somewhere like Nigeria, where it's highly entrepreneurial, things like this are an opportunity rather than a problem, I guess.
Yes, and I mean, even in any of those cities, you get a lot of women selling street food. Now, actually, street food is not always eaten on the street. Sometimes people come home from work, pick up the food and eat it at home. And so that's a real opportunity. And then you've got ideas like Uber Eats. I know, again, many of your listeners may not realize how many mobile phones Africans have, but they do have mobile phones, and they could actually be, you know, offering, I've got 10 portions of Ugali extra. I'm 200 yards away. Do you want it? You know, and that's, So we're exploring trying to move the cooking sector in Africa and Asia. I'll come back to my 1.7 billion in Asia that have electricity, have phones, move them into the 21st century so that when we get to 2030, actually there are a lot less people that are killing themselves by cooking on wood and charcoal.
Arne, you've been incredibly patient, waiting for to get to you. Now, I understand the program's not just focused on household cooking. So what else is there? What other scenarios are you looking at?
Look, there's so many different scenarios, and I'm really, really passionate about MEC's strategy to look at the aspiration of just leaving no one behind. We've got a stream that looks at displacement in humanitarian settings and also at institutional settings. So, back in 2017, I was lucky enough to visit a refugee camp in Rwanda, and I got to speak to the refugees there. And when you speak to the men and women in these committees, and I asked the question, what do you prioritize when you think about energy? And all the men would say electricity. And then all the women said cooking. And so cooking is predominantly a burden placed on women and children in terms of collecting firewood and being there all day cooking the meals for the families. And, you know, what is cooking? Cooking is life. If you don't eat, you don't live. So it's really important that the MEX program focuses on these settings that make sure that women and children aren't left behind. And so it's really important that when we talk about household cooking, that we include those poorest of the poor that don't have access to cooking needs.
And again, the burden falling on women is extraordinary. And again, it's really hard to visualize until you're there. In India, we saw the women going out for firewood. Now, you know, it sounds like the simplest thing. We'll nip out and we'll just get some firewood. It's impossible. They would be out for about 2 hours collecting enough firewood for the day, maybe a day and a half of cooking. So they're collecting the water, they're collecting the firewood. There are risks involved with going to get these things because you're out of the community, you're at risk from you know, whoever might be out there, attack or you know, various different problems that can occur once you're out of your safe zone. And it's really hard to visualize that all of this burden seems to fall on women.
Yeah, gender-based violence is a huge issue in kind of the displacement refugee setting, considering that a lot of these refugees do not have the rights to work, cannot leave the environment, and even though the large international organization gives a small portion of firewood to cook per month, it's not enough. And so they have to forage. And considering that when they go out, it's illegal, they don't report these violences against them. And so it's a continual cycle of despondent people getting even worse and worse situations just because of their where they are and being forced out of their homes.
So India is a great example, Stefan, of this potential of electrification. They claim that they have now electrified 98% of all villages in India. Now, the claim has some caveats to it. The wire reaches the village and at least 10% have connected to that wire. So it doesn't mean that 98% of households are connected to electricity, but the potential is there. India is very ambitious, you know, to actually, and as long as it's recognized as a cheaper expenditure for the family than actually going out and being accosted or going out and paying the fine because you're collecting illegally from a forest, you know, it then becomes standard household economics as to whether people will take it up or not.
And Arne, I guess we're talking about quite complex infrastructure with electricity, but again, if you're going to invest in a country, it, you know, it's a bit like, don't buy people food, buy them, you know, give them the resources to build a road, and then you give them the infrastructure within which they can actually work. And the same thing, I guess, goes for electricity. If you're building infrastructure, then there are untold other opportunities that you're creating from that.
Definitely. So sustainability is a huge issue within these displacement and institutional settings. So just imagine 5 football fields are cut down every day to feed people in Bangladesh, in the Rohingya's refugee camps. And that's a huge amount of you know, deforestation that happens around there, and the influx of people came within months. And so there needs to be an alternative solution. So people such as UNHCR are trialing LPGs in these camps. And while this is still an intermediate step change, which is extraordinarily different from what they are, and has been quite successful, it's still, they're still spending $1 million per month to sustain this. So it's not a sustainable long-term solution. And electricity generated by new renewable energy in the place in the time is potentially a step change for these situations.
Yeah, because cutting down the, you know, it sounds like a simple thing, go and get some firewood, but what you're doing there is if you're removing the biomass from there, you know, it's like somebody having a mango tree and you have a medical emergency, you've got to burn the mango tree for charcoal and sell that, and that'll get you $50. Now that's great because you've got a medical emergency. Now you have no mango tree, and it causes systemic problems that further down the line.
Yeah, well. Erosion, you know, lack of infrastructure, and just the actually the conflict with host communities is an issue within these displacement settings. So when we work with these refugee communities and displacement communities, we also work with host communities to make sure that there's a sense of solidarity with them. And so they're seen as a coping solution for humanity and not just the special few that gets international help.
Yeah. Now, how about on a different scale? What about cooking in schools and things like that? I mean, obviously, you need a larger pot, but how does the concept of cooking change, and can electricity still support all of that?
I just want your viewers just to imagine a pot, not just any pot, a pot that's 1.5 meters across. You can actually sit in this bathtub. That's how big these porridge pots are within these schools. And they feed hundreds of children per day. And so what this cooking is these heavy beans, as Simon mentioned before. They normally cook beans or porridge or rice, really simple foods that don't need much, but it's about heating the food and water. And I've been to these schools that you mentioned before, Stefan, and it's like putting your face in a campfire. And these people work all day in that environment. It just needs to change. And the thing is, the technology is out there. It's just the political will, the economic will to make a change. There's innovation that needs to happen in terms of cooking, like a pressure cooker and those large pots, you know, physics and a big explosive tin can. Not very sustainable, but we're looking.
I'm not going in the kitchen. I'm not going in.
And I think one of the really interesting things about this whole area is when we first started thinking about these kinds of issues, then when people talk about clean cooking, they talk about the household. But then when you start thinking about, so, you know, Simon talking about the amount of people that buy food from outside the house, and that really, you think, well, that's quite a proportion of the amount of cooking that goes on. But then if you think somewhere like Kenya, you think, what a young population this is. So maybe of those that are at school age, maybe that's, what do you think, that 30, 40% of the population is at that kind of age. And then there is a requirement of all schools in Kenya to provide 3 meals a day to those students. So immediately, when you start thinking about to what degree are we addressing the need for clean cooking within each of these countries, then if we're not tackling the issues that Anne is leading on in this program, then we're not tackling clean cooking. So I think that's something that as we kind of begun to reflect on what we were doing, that we realized that, you know, this is absolutely crucial. What Anne is doing is one of, if not the most central parts of the whole program, because of those challenges. And no one or very, very few people are actually thinking about it in those terms.
And what stage are you at with all of this?
So we're at the initial stage where we're undertaking a landscape study, both within displacement settings and institutional cooking. And we hopefully, through that research, we'll be able to develop an action plan to work with large organisations such as the World Food Programme or the UNHCR to develop really innovative modern energy cooking. And we're not just looking at technology changes, we're looking at political changes, we're looking at economic market-based approaches within these environments, because one of the biggest things is funding. These organizations work on one-year funding cycles, and if you think about $1 million per month on LPG alone, if you can just accumulate that over a number of years, you can pay off a large solar system within the camps, within a school setting, and pay that off within 5 years. It's just economic sense, and it's not done because there's no political will to change a system that works on 1 year cycles. So we work on a whole range of levels, not just technology, but political, legal, economic, social. It's a very complex field, but we're ready to take the challenge.
Okay, well, this brings us on to Nick. Nick Russo, you've been even more patient than Arne has. Thank you very much for hanging on for us. So tell us all about the role of businesses. So there's some extraordinary challenges here. Who are you working with to address these? How is all this going to unfold?
Sure, thank you. Well, I've been enjoying being in MEX for about a year now, and it's been so motivating for me personally. And I think we've actually seen that motivation passing into some of these companies you're working with. So, and I guess the best example of that, Simon and I went to China back end of last year while we were still able to do that. And we visited a large EPC company, Midea. And we talked to a group of engineers about the opportunities in Africa and our research. And one of them got immensely excited when he saw one of the photos of one of our cooking diary studies. And he said, "That is the EPC that I designed." So he had a personal connection with it, and he had never thought that he was doing something which could save lives. He thought he was just shipping product, you know, making something which people would like in the Western world. And I think he has kept in touch with us, and they are really excited that they can have this kind of beneficial impact. So we're now talking to a whole bunch of other companies. So Instant Brands has been mentioned, Group Seb, Morphy Richards, Panasonic, Bosch. They're all really interested. They're all keen to get engaged. They need help with understanding how to do that, because it's unfamiliar territory for many of them, as well as some of the very large Indian and Chinese companies. And what we're basically looking for is a kind of combination of established brands that have a lot of expertise in cooking and cooking devices, making them energy efficient, but also innovative companies that are really going to come in with some entirely new solutions that could be from any sector, from the food sector, from the bakery sector. We talked about the challenges of making bread, but it could be from other sectors. And because it's a combination, any solution is going to be a combination of energy efficient cooking and the kind of devices that you can cook within, but also that wider energy context, storage, managing energy, helping people to use energy across a mini grid scenario. And then the further context of what novel business models will actually make this a viable option for people in the developing world. So it's got to be a mixture of a collaborative approach in practice.
This thing about business models, Stefan, I mean, you know, some of your listeners will be thinking, oh, but can they afford, you know, $100 Instant Pot? Well, actually, if it's a service arrangement with, say, a utility, then they can receive the appliance. You know, we used to rent our televisions. Well, if you go back to that sort of idea, you can be given the appliance and then just pay it on your bill, you know, $2 a month for the next whatever. And you can't exactly run away. It's a connection to electricity. So, you know, it becomes a very natural on-bill financing. But then for the more remote locations, if we're talking about solar PV arrangements, you know, even that, the lighting industry, the solar lighting industry, has found this thing called pay as you go. And basically, equipment is given to the family, and then they pay regularly through the mobile money to actually keep it enabled. And there is a cutoff switch, so if they don't pay, it gets cut off.
And I think, again, a lot of people in the UK aren't really aware that mobile phone banking is a really huge deal, and microbanking. It's highly functioning, as you say. I mean, again, even in refugee camps, I think that was the thing I was most surprised about, was that most people in refugee camps have a mobile phone, and you kind of think, how does this square up? But, you know, these things are actually very low cost, and they are essential, you know, especially with fragmented communities to keep people in touch. Just back to you, Nick. What can you offer these companies? What will they get? What's the opportunity for them?
Well, I think the opportunity ultimately are huge markets that we are identifying. The challenge, obviously, is working out, well, what product will fit in those markets and how to find a way into those markets and how to make a profit. You know, these companies are companies. They're not there just for the goodness of others. Ed's already referred to the grants that we can provide to support innovation and support market research and piloting. We're now moving into that phase where we're funding a number of pilots that will help to build that knowledge base. But we also want, again, I think Ed referred to it, to support the scale up of the really promising solutions. So and that's the kind of the two sides of what we're offering people. So in India, we're partnering with an Indian government innovation agency to run a collaborative innovation program with Tata Trust, which runs something called Social Alpha. And they will help companies that have successful solutions to work out how to manufacture those solutions at scale, how to provide the microfinance that will enable people to get into the markets. And I think what I'm finding, as I say, is that a lot of the companies that are familiar with European or North American markets have trouble understanding how they might engage with a developing country market. So we're looking to build a picture of those markets in terms of segments. So there's your affluent middle class in Nairobi, in Nigeria, wherever. And then you've got people who are slightly less affluent but have grid connection. Then you have people with mini grids. Then you have people with solar home systems. And the more you can set that out, each of those will require a different engagement strategy. Some of them, you can just put it out into the shops, the retailers. And we're looking at those, looking at what's available already, working with the distributors. Others, you'll have to work with the Kenya Light and Power Company, who will then be able to send it out through their networks of their supply customers. Others, you work with mini grid companies. So by identifying the partners in country, we can then help these companies to find their way in and to build a solution. The other thing that I think we've not touched on is in order to address the affordability challenges, we're also looking to ensure we can facilitate bulk purchase. So you can get economies of scale if you can get a national organization or an NGO to buy electric pressure cookers at scale and then make them available through normal market means. And we've invested in something called the Global Leap Award for electric pressure cookers. So this is something that's been done for a range of different types of device to identify energy efficient appliances for the developing world. And we've now done this for electric pressure cookers so that we can establish a robust quality standard against which all devices can be assessed that the companies want to have nominated. So that ensures that the buyer is buying a product which is going to be safe and that's usable and appropriate for the conditions. And that will create a buyer's guide that will be published in the autumn. And it's that buyer's guide that people will be looking for when they want to pilot EPCs in different contexts, or if they want to buy in bulk, or they want to make devices available like Kenya Light and Power. So we're creating that kind of market enabling role in opening up these opportunities to help the affordability challenge. The final point I wanted to make was coming back to what Simon was saying about the carbon emission savings that you can get from this. That is true also of improved cook stoves, but in order to demonstrate that you have changed the way people cook, you have to go out and visit hundreds of homes to monitor how they cook. If you're using electric devices, you can very simply gather data on the energy use that people are demonstrating in their households. And that means that we're building a framework that will enable people who implement clean cooking devices, particularly with electricity, to gain carbon credits. So that will again further subsidize the cost of those devices, and even in some cases potentially could bring some revenue for the households themselves. We're looking at different models there.
Yeah. Okay, well, this is one of the most fascinating podcasts I think we've done, but we are running out of time. So, Ed, can I come back to you for some final comments? What next for the MEX program?
Continue to grow, I think, is that you know, a lot of background research has been done in the first 2 years of the program, a lot of landscaping, a lot of taking our ideas and really beginning to run with them. So I think now is the kind of the proof is in the eating, in a sense, thinking about it and using the analogy in that way. So I think,
proof is in the heating.
Yeah. Heating. So I think there are whole drawing on what a lot of people have said. So I think we are moving into the beyond the household areas. So I think things like the pre-cooking and the institutional, I think those are areas that are massively important and we really see a massive opportunity for. I think also what we were talking about in terms of how do we reduce the cost overall to the populations that we're trying to serve. So we've talked about that in terms of bulk buying. We've talked about it in terms of the design of the equipment itself. We're also, and I think Nick just began to touch on it, in terms of things like carbon credits. There's also things like impact bonds. So there's a whole range of different types of activity which we're investing in. It's also raising more resources to flow into this area. So we're working with social investment funds like Acumen in terms of investing into their portfolio of companies that are looking to embrace this type of technology. So it's that kind of level. It's also embracing, getting people to getting the international community to see what this can achieve and the connections that there are. If we deal with this issue, then in terms of dealing with some of the drudgery, the most worst elements of drudgery of women's lives, as Anne was saying. So in that sense, if we're able to show that, then if we can increase the amount of international commitment so that the amount of resources going into clean cooking match those going into electrification, you know, that kind of thing. So for example, next week we have we're speaking at a high level meeting, a UN high level meeting that's being held virtually. We've got a side event at that meeting that's being coordinated by the Kenyan government. And so we've got into those kinds of spaces to be able to put this message across. So it's also individual countries and developments with those countries. So recently, Nepal, for example, made a very big momentous decision, which was to shift from subsidizing gas for cooking to move to subsidizing electricity. So we and various partners of ours, such as the Clean Cooking Alliance, such as the World Bank, such as HIVOS, are working with the Nepal government to work out how that can best be delivered in that sense. There was also a whole set of stories in the media this week in Kenya about the Kenyan government taking the first tentative kind of steps towards promoting cooking with electricity. They made a bit of a maybe not didn't do it quite as well as they might have done, but there are real opportunities, I think, for us to build on that momentum. So where there is momentum, where we can change the narrative around these kinds of issues. And then I guess finally, it's things like the next round of our Challenge Fund activity is beginning now to take off. So from a situation where we had in Kenya people beginning to work on the national grid, we now have a number of other countries where we begin to work on the national grid. From a situation where we maybe had four or five mini grid companies experimenting, now under this we've got six or seven more that we're working with in different contexts. So it's in each of these different areas, it's growing what we're doing, it's getting that message out there and not allowing what we're currently all living through to kind of throw us off course in a sense. It's actually, if anything, it's even more important during this period of during the COVID crisis in terms of can we help the international community to build back better in terms of what was there. This is a massive challenge for the globe. As Simon said when we started off, the fact that we're living in 2020 and that there are, he says 3 billion. Actually, the latest report that's coming out this summer, looking at who has actually got access to modern energy cooking services, it's 4 billion people. So in that sense, it's being able to recognise this is not acceptable. This is not acceptable that we're in this situation. And we know that there are ways in which we can address this if we have the commitment at the political level, if we have the right policies, and if we have the investment in order to enable us to meet the challenges that we've identified through this programme.
So just to say, as Ed has summed up, we are very interested. We're very aware that this podcast is going out to the food industry, and that many of you who are listening might have ideas that have been sparked. You might have insights that would be very helpful to us. So if you do want to get in touch, do please get in touch with Nick, through Nick, and we would welcome that interaction.
It's really interesting because there, as you say, there are massive challenges, but the potential for solving at least some of the problem at least is vast, you know. And I'm really impressed by the integrated approach. You know, it's not just inventing a cook stove and hoping for the best, but actually talking to businesses, understanding the cultural sensitivities of it as well. But I think people just simply don't understand that household air pollution doesn't just kill people; it causes untold misery. You know, respiratory illnesses in poor communities is just absolutely devastating, and the potential to improve lives is vast here. So it's really exciting. So I really look forward to finding out how it unfolds. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters, and this week in partnership with Loughborough University. You heard from Ed Brown, MEX Research Director, Nick Russo, International Liaison Manager, Simon Batchelor, UK Research and Innovation Coordinator, Arne Tran, International Liaison Manager, and me, Stephen Gates. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to gut microbiome analysis. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And also to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.